Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, and as always, my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland, is alongside. Good to be with you again, Laura.
Yes, nice to be here, Dennis.
We have plenty to talk about on this particular episode, including the state legislature's approval of new state and congressional redistricting maps and the passage of a bill giving Iowans the right to get jobless benefits if they are fired for not complying with employee vaccine mandates. We're going to get to all of it, but first, let's talk about the story that broke over the weekend, the strike against the John Deere Company, a tentative settlement by the United Auto Workers with the Deere Company. Workers will be voting on that this week. Let's talk about some of the details of that settlement, Laura.
Yes, well, what we know, it hasn't, the full package hasn't been published, but what we know is that workers would get an immediate 10% a pay raise. There would be 5% pay raises following that in the coming years. And so it's basically double the pay increase that the previous offer had. There would also be slightly better retirement benefits. It does keep the two-tier system. A lot of the Deere workers wanted to get rid of the two-tier system. That means that the people hired before 1997 have a much better deal in terms of benefits, especially retirement, than the newer hires. But it gets rid of what they had proposed, a third tier, so that people hired after this current contract went into effect would have even less benefits, and they got rid of that third tier in this offer. So I saw the Des Moines Register quoted someone from the Ottumwa UAW local, and he said that he was planning to vote in favor of the contract, and he was so very publicly critical of the first contract. So I thought if he's on board with this, then that could indicate that quite a lot of his colleagues would also be voting for it. The vote is supposed to happen tomorrow, on Tuesday, rather.
So that means right now the lowest pay level at Deere is about $20 an hour, and the highest is about $30. They're scheduled to get under this deal 10% immediately or very soon, and then 5% again in 2023-2025. So what does that look like? Does it look like it's a good deal from the outside, from your point of view, for the workers?
Well, I mean, real wages in this country have been stagnant since about 1970. So something that involves an increase like that, I saw one estimate that running through the life of this contract, which would end in 2027, some workers would see a 30% increase in their wages over the life of the contract. So that would certainly be more than what the overall trajectory of wages are in the United States. One thing I have read about the Deere employees is that they don't always get 40-hour weeks, that their schedules can be a little irregular. Sometimes they're taking on extra shifts, but there can be times of the year where they have a little bit less work. So somebody was saying you can't necessarily just extrapolate from that hourly wage and assume that you know what they're going to be making over the course of the year. But this is definitely a much better offer than the first negotiated agreement, the one that was rejected by about 90% of the UAW members.
And we're also being told that each union member is going to get $8,500 if they approve the contract, $8,500 in a lump sum payment. How usual is that?
I think that's unusual. I mean, I'm not an expert on labor contracts, but that isn't something that I've read about. And also the contract would offer lump sum payments to workers when they retire. That would be based on how long they've been with a company. But workers who have been with a company for at least 25 years before they retire would get a $50,000 lump sum at retirement. And most companies don't even offer any kind of pension program anymore. So that would be on top of the pension that is part of their contract agreement.
As you say, they'll be voting on this. The workers will be voting on this this week. We'll have much more next week on Capital Week. But just a couple of other quickies about Deere last week. A 56-year-old Deere Company employee, Richard Rich, died after a car hit him. He was walking to a picket line at a Deere warehouse in Milan, Illinois. A tragedy. It happened in the dark, early morning darkness, in an unlighted or poorly lighted street. He was part of United Auto Workers Local 79. All you can say is it was an unfortunate tragedy.
It was a tragedy, and I read that some of the people who had been picketing out there had complained to the city and had said that that was poorly lit. There was a light that was not functioning. And they didn't come and fix the light until a day or two after that his tragic death. But I mean, it's something that I've been concerned about. I know that the street that they've been picketing on in Ankeny is one with a high speed limit, and it can be very dark there, and people are driving fast. And so I was very sorry to hear that report last week.
And one more quick note, a Polk County judge last week denied the Deere Company's request to restrict picketing at the Ankeny campus. A judge said the company had failed to prove that UAW members broke any laws after going on strike October 14th. It's probably now in the long term not going to matter, but the judge did deny the Deere Company's request.
Yes, I mean, it was in great contrast to the judge over in Scott County who approved the request for that injunction without even holding a hearing on it. The Polk County judge had a hearing and both sides got to present their arguments. So I think that was one of the big differences. And I know that the attorneys for the UAW were fighting that injunction over in Scott County that said that they could have no more than four people on the line. They couldn't have burn barrels. They couldn't have chairs even for people. So that seemed like rather extreme, especially since it was imposed without any kind of a hearing.
All right, let's move on to the jumbo in the room in terms of Iowa politics, and that is the state legislature, as Laura Bellin predicted on this very broadcast 1 week ago. You can listen to it. It's all on tape somewhere. The state legislature approved a new set of political boundaries, completing the state's every 10-year redistricting process. It was the map that was unveiled the week before by the Legislative Services Agency. It upends almost everything we know now in terms of boundaries on the congressional districts, on state senate, state house districts. There's so much to talk about. And Laura, let's just start peeling it layer by layer in a very simple form. Let's start talking about the four congressional districts. What does this map mean for them?
Well, in some ways, it's very close to a status quo map. I mean, the bulk of each district doesn't change very much. The one thing that's a little bit confusing is, for some reason, the Legislative Services Agency flipped the numbers on the first and the second districts, and I don't know why they did that. A lot of readers have been asking me why. So what used to be known as the second district, that covers most of southeast Iowa, that's now the first district. That includes Iowa City, the Quad Cities area, and everything to the south of that. And it stretches all the way to Warren County, that's just south of Polk County, and Jasper County, containing Newton. So it stretches a bit into central Iowa, but broadly, that first district is southeast Iowa. The second district covers the northeast part of the state. It used to be called the first district, again, so a little bit confusing, but the population centers haven't changed. That's Cedar Rapids area, Dubuque, and Waterloo, Cedar Falls are the main population counties. And it took in some of the counties that used to be in the fourth district, but basically it's the counties in the northeast part of the state. The third district, which is where Cindy Axne is, that includes Polk County and Dallas County. That's about 75% of the population of the district, and then it stretches farther to the south. It includes a lot of counties on the southern two tiers. It loses Pottawatomie County, which is where Council Bluffs is. That's the main change there. And then the fourth district, which is all of northwest Iowa, it now stretches all the way down the west, all the way down the Missouri River to Fremont County. It still includes Story and Boone County, and it has taken in Marshall County. That's the farthest east that fourth district goes. So Marshall County, Marshalltown area. But otherwise, again, like I said, it's much more of a status quo map than the first plan from the Legislative Services Agency was.
So the most publicized change and the most publicized decision that has to be made involving these district changes involves the third congressional district, which is now going to include Wapello County. That's where Cindy Axne, the Democrat, is the congressperson. But Wapello County is also the home of Republican Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks. So somebody has to make a decision there. Is Marionette Miller Meeks going to move? What's your feeling on that?
I'm very confident she's moving. She has not what she's doing. But Marionette Miller Meeks first ran for Congress in 2008. She ran four times, and she was elected finally on her fourth try. But she's been running in the southeast Iowa counties for more than a decade. And even though her home in the Ottumwa area is no longer part of this district, it would be very easy for her to move into one of the counties in this new first district. And I think that makes a lot more sense than for her to try to challenge Cindy Axne when the eight counties that Marionette Miller Meeks currently represents that are now part of the 3rd District, that only makes up about 12% of the population of the 3rd District. And as I mentioned, Polk and Dallas County, the Des Moines metro area, that makes up about 75% of the population of the new district. So it's just, Ottumwa is just not a very good base from which to a campaign in the 3rd District. And Marionette Miller Meeks has invested a lot of time and energy in getting to know the constituents in those southeast Iowa counties. So I do imagine that she'll move to the 1st District. I think that makes sense for her. It is significant, though, that she loses her home county, Wapello, because that's an area where she's overperformed. She's performed better than the top of the Republican ticket in the past because of her long medical practice in the area. And considering that she only won by 6 votes in 2020, she'll probably need to make up a little bit of slack in some of the other counties. Of course, she does have the advantage of incumbency now, which she didn't have 2 years ago.
So Cindy Axne, as we said, is the 3rd District Congressperson, Democrat, and she has not yet made public whether she's going to run for re-election. She apparently is still toying around with the idea of running for governor. What are you hearing?
Well, yes, she has not ruled out running for governor. I will be fairly surprised if she runs for governor. I expect that with this map, she's probably going to run in the 3rd District again. I think that she's fairly well positioned. I mean, it's not, of course, the 3rd District could be a lot better for Democrats, but it could be worse. And Polk County gives her a strong base to run on. The population in Polk and Dallas has grown. She's lost that Council Bluffs area. That's probably a little bit helpful to her. So I think that she's, I would say she's more likely to run for Congress, but I don't have that information directly from her. So she has not ruled out running for governor. She worked for many years in state government, so she understands state government fairly well, and I think she enjoyed her time working in state government, and so that's why she's left open that possibility of running for governor.
Why did the GOP decide to approve this set of maps? Was it because Johnson and Linn counties were separated, Cedar Rapids and Iowa City? Is that what gave them the go-ahead, the green light to approve these?
Well, I think I think that generally legislators look at the state legislative maps more than they look at the congressional map. And the state legislative maps were good on this map. So the state legislative maps give them a very good chance of maintaining their Iowa House and Senate majority. So I think that was the first point. If the state legislative maps had not been good for the Republican Party, I don't think they would have approved it. The congressional maps, what they like about it is that all 4 congressional districts are areas that Donald Trump carried in 2020. So there are a lot of different ways to divide up the state, but what this map does is it keeps the 4 biggest Democratic vote producers, that's Linn County, Cedar Rapids, Johnson County, Iowa City area, Polk County, Des Moines area, and Story County, Ames, and puts them in 4 different districts. If any 2 of those were part of the same district, that would be fairly safe for Democrats, and that's what Republicans didn't want to see. So this map gives them a chance to sweep all 4 congressional districts in a good year. Now, the flip side of that, as a lot of the redistricting nerds will tell you, is that this is a map that in a good year for Democrats, Democrats could win 3 out of the 4 seats, which is what happened in 2018. But I think Republicans feel good about the recent trends in Iowa and the way things are going, and they like their chances. And the first map created a lot of problems for Ashley Hinson, which was their first district representative. And this one is much better for her. She gets to run in a district that's very similar to where she won in 2020.
So the next part of our discussion gets a little complicated, and we're going to simplify it. I believe you called people who like redistricting last week, Laura, last week or the week before, redistricting nerds. Was that the term you used on the air here?
Yes.
So I know you're not a nerd, but you're very smart. The new maps, bear in mind, to set the stage, there are 150 state lawmakers in Iowa, 100 House members, 50 senators, state senators. The GOP controls 60 of the 100 seats in the House, 32 of the 50 in the Senate. Now, these new maps group 58 of those 150 lawmakers together. What kind of a mess can we expect here? We've got 20 of Iowa's 50 sitting senators going to be grouped together along with 38 of the 100 House members. Is that anything less than a mess?
Now, I don't think it's much of a mess. For a few people, it's a serious problem, but for most of them, it's not a big problem because there are a number of open seats where there's no incumbent now, And some of these incumbent matchups have already been resolved with people announcing that they're going to move and run in a different district. One of those state senators, Craig Johnson, who was placed in the same district as another person, he announced he's dropping down to run for the Iowa House seat that forms half of that Senate district. So I just think it won't be a big issue. One of the Iowa House Republicans who is paired up with somebody else is going to be running for the open Senate. That there are a lot of opportunities. There are a few of them. It's a real problem, particularly the farmers. It's not so easy for them to move, obviously. But I don't think that this is any different from any normal redistricting cycle. We always see quite a few legislators moving. And I think most of the time they work it out, and it rarely leads to people running against each other in a primary. I mean, that does happen occasionally, but not very often. In 2012, there were two fairly hard-fought Republican primaries for state legislative seats, but I don't expect many more than that this year.
It's 15 and a half after the hour in whatever time zone you're listening, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We're here every week at this hour to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Laura, while all of this was going on last week, while the state legislature was busy confirming these maps, they did something else that almost came from left field. They took advantage of the special session on redistricting to pass a bill giving residents more latitude to claim medical and religious exemptions from employer coronavirus vaccination mandates, and giving residents the ability to qualify for jobless benefits if a business fires them for not complying. This became a national story. Did anybody see this one coming?
I think so, because there were these activists who were wanting some kind of legislative action against vaccine mandates. They were there on October 5th, the day of the first special legislative session. They wanted the Republicans to do something that day. Nothing happened. No bill was introduced, and they were very upset about it. And these people have been sending hundreds, if not thousands, of messages to state legislators for months now, demanding some kind of action. So I think felt a lot of pressure to take care of this. So I did hear that something was probably coming down the pike, but I didn't know the details. I don't think anybody in the media or in the Democratic caucuses saw any of the details until the morning or early afternoon of last Thursday when they unveiled this law. But it's interesting, or the bill, rather, that is now a law because the governor signed it on Friday. I mean, what's interesting is that the activists wanted legislation to ban businesses from imposing vaccine mandates, and this doesn't do that at all. It says it does make it easier for people to submit waivers that businesses are supposed to accept, but it doesn't say businesses can't fire you for refusing to get a vaccination. It just says that if you're fired, you can collect unemployment. And as a number of the Democratic lawmakers, including even some of them who ended up voting for the bill, pointed out, the unemployment doesn't last forever. Then, and it's also not comparable for most people. It's not comparable to what their wages were. So that's not really what people were looking for, was a bill that would give them access to unemployment for some limited amount of time, like 26 weeks. They're looking to be able to stay in their jobs without getting vaccinated. So in that sense, I mean, those groups were definitely not declaring victory. Some of them were fairly upset with how things played out on Thursday.
You mentioned something I don't think we should let pass. It's that some Democrats voted for this Republican bill. Did they feel almost forced into voting for this?
Well, I wouldn't say they were forced into it. I mean, it was a 12 Democrats in the House and 13 in the Senate. So it was a significant number. It's more than we usually see when Republicans spring this last minute legislation. Usually those bills pass almost along party lines or very close to party lines. And I did notice that, for instance, Christina Bohannon, who is the Democratic candidate in the new 1st Congressional District, that's the Southeast District, and also State Senator Liz Mathis, who is running in the Northeast District, which is now the 2nd District, they both voted for it. I think that for a lot of Democrats, they didn't want to be voting against people collecting unemployment if they're fired. They also didn't want to be portrayed as being against people having the freedom to refuse a vaccine. But it was a bit of a scrambled vote. I mean, there were a lot of people who came down on the other side of the bill, and it was a strange bill because the business lobby groups were against it. Usually You don't have the Republican leadership and the Republican caucuses going against something that the business, going against a position of the business lobby. So it was a bit of a scramble. But I think that most of the Democrats who spoke about why they supported the bill, they just said that they feel that people who lose their jobs should have access to unemployment. But several of them were very critical of the way the bill was structured, and they said it doesn't really do what Republicans were claiming that it accomplishes for Iowans.
Just briefly talking more about vaccines, Iowa joined 9 other states last week in suing the Biden administration over its vaccine requirement for workers employed by a federal contractor. The other states, Alaska, Arkansas, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. So Iowa, again, consistent with Governor Reynolds' feeling that we're going to resist anything involving mandates that the federal government wants.
Yes, and I don't know the case law in this area, so I really don't know what their prospects are for succeeding here. But I think it's interesting the governor is really playing both sides of this vaccine issue, because she's still saying, for a while, she was out there regularly promoting the vaccine. And now she says, occasionally, she says, I do think people should get vaccinated, and that's our best line of defense, but... And then much more of her public discourse now is about people's freedom to refuse vaccines and how the government shouldn't be requiring vaccines. And so, you know, I think that her rhetoric increasingly is more aligned with people who oppose the vaccines, even though she is still on the record. She's, of course, vaccinated herself, and she's still on the record saying that Iowans should get vaccinated, but her actions don't really match those words. And I think that the reason is because we've seen in polls, whether it's 25 or 30 or 35% of people who very strongly don't want to get vaccinated, a large part of that is the Republican-based voter. So I think that the governor is trying to behave in a way that will satisfy her base while also not exactly discouraging people from getting vaccinated.
And on this day, the health department reported that 6,652 more positive cases of the virus had been confirmed. That was about 200 more cases than had been reported on Friday. The state's 14-day positivity rate went up to 8.1%. So the virus is not going down very quickly here in Iowa.
No, and the weather's getting colder, and the epidemiologists have been telling us that as people start spending more time indoors in the colder weather, they're expecting a rise, not just in COVID-19, but in influenza and the other usual respiratory illnesses that people spread when they're in close quarters. So I've seen that the hospitalization numbers for COVID-19 have dropped a bit, but I've seen a lot of the healthcare experts express concern because we're still at a point where we're early. This is not usually the time when the hospitals are very crowded in the flu season, and they're just a little bit worried about what happens as we start to see more cases of flu and RSV and some of those other things that tend to put people in the hospital in the winter months. It's not easy to find an ICU bed in most parts of Iowa still. There are people who are having to wait longer than usual for a transfer from a smaller hospital to a regional medical center. And so we're far from being out of the woods on this pandemic.
Right. There was also a report this past week, one more note on the coronavirus, that at least 59,000 meatpacking workers in Iowa and all across the nation, 59,000 had gotten sick from the virus and 269 had died since the pandemic began. Now, earlier estimates by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union had reported that about 22,000 workers had been infected. So this is more than twice as much. And it just confirms what we thought at the time. The meatpacking industry at that point was just a spreader of the virus in those buildings.
Yes. I mean, those buildings were almost an ideal setting for the virus to spread. People working close together. The air was moist. They're working long shifts. Many people are carpooling together to and from the plants. And so, I mean, it was just a disaster. And I want to say that even though these are higher numbers than we've seen, it's very likely that this is understating the true scale of the pandemic in the meatpacking industry, because this report, the congressional report, was based on documents from 5 of the largest meatpacking companies, and that is, it's more than 80% of the market for beef and more than 60% of the market for pork. But that's far from 100% of meatpacking, and we know that there were a lot of outbreaks in some of the smaller companies as well. Also, when they calculated that at least 269 meatpacking workers lost their lives to COVID-19, that doesn't count anybody who was a household member, of a meatpacking worker. I mean, there were cases I remember that were reported last spring where a man who passed away, his wife worked in an egg factory. She brought home the virus and everybody in their household got sick. The husband died and one of the adult daughters was on a ventilator for a while. She did recover, but there were many cases where somebody got sick working in meatpacking. Somebody else in the household worked in a nursing home and brought the virus there. So, I mean, the knock-on effects from these outbreaks in meatpacking, they caused a large number of cases and deaths, far higher than what was even reported in this new study published last week.
Right. All right, let's turn to elections. We have about 4.5 minutes left. Elections are going to take place in Iowa on Tuesday. I should make it very clear, we are live on Monday night. The election is on Tuesday across Iowa for mayors, city council members, and school board members. New rules are going to be in place in terms of voting deadlines. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But you wrote on Bleeding Heartland that a Democratic state senator has ruled out running for governor. Talk about that, please.
So Pam Yoakum, who's represented the Dubuque area for a very long time, she was first elected to the Iowa House in 1992 and elected to the Senate in 2008. And when the Democrats had control of the Senate, she was the second ranking person in the caucus. She was the Senate president. So she had pondered running for governor in 2014, and she was taking another very close look at it this time. She was just reelected to a 4-year term in Dubuque, so she could have run for governor next year without giving up her seat in the legislature. But she told me today that she had decided against doing that. She said that after speaking with many people, she realized that it would take about $15 million to run an effective statewide campaign, and this would just be too late to get going with that to run an effective campaign. But she said she thinks that Kim Reynolds is vulnerable, but she feels that her place is to continue to be a strong voice in the legislature. So that leaves two candidates, Democrats we know about running for governor, Deirdre Jaeger, who was the 2018 nominee for Secretary of State, and Roz Smith, who is in the Iowa House representing a district from Waterloo. And then other people considering it, as we mentioned, Cindy Axne and State Auditor Rob Sand has still not ruled out running for governor himself.
All right, let's talk about some of the elections that are going to take place on Tuesday. School boards have become a particularly hot issue and a location for real political act outs in the past year or so, past weeks or so in Iowa and across the country, with mask mandates, vaccine mandates, all on the table. School boards members have been yelled at, cursed at, all of this. Have you ever seen anything like this in Iowa?
No, and one thing that's different, the Republicans changed the law in 2018. We used to have school board elections in September and city elections in November, and those were combined beginning with the 2019 election cycle. So tomorrow, Iowans are going to be electing city council members and mayors as well as school board members. And the idea behind this was to increase turnout for the school board races because Republicans felt that the teachers' union was able to influence the school board elections too much when they were in September and the turnout was lower. But what I'm seeing now also that's different, and I'm not saying it's unprecedented because it has happened before, but I'm seeing a lot more of it this year, is city council and school board candidates running on a slate. So distributing literature together, saying vote for these three candidates or these four candidates for the seats that are open rather than everybody running their own campaign. We're seeing much more of the ideologically aligned candidates trying to run on a slate. And so I'm going to be watching closely to see what happens. The conservative activists who oppose masks in schools and some of the other coronavirus mitigation, they've been very active. There are also other candidates who are running more for stronger safety measures, and some of them are also running on slates. So we'll see what happens. But certainly there is heightened interest in these school board races compared to past years.
And about a minute to go, we should remind people that there is a new deadline for getting your ballot in. And remember, the election is Tuesday. If you have not mailed your ballot in, it isn't going to be counted.
It's got to be hand-delivered to the county auditor's office by 8 p.m. on Tuesday evening, and it has to be hand-delivered either by the voter or somebody in the voter's household or a family member in most cases. So you can't just give it to a campaign volunteer, but absolutely don't put any of those ballots in the mail because they will not be counted.
And given what you know about Iowa politics, which I think is almost everything, what kind of turnout would you expect tomorrow? I know I'm not asking for a specific number, but do you think there's a lot of interest out there in these elections?
I think it'll be higher than usual. I mean, turnout is always lower for the local elections. So, I mean, it's usually well below 20%, but in some cities, a little bit higher than that. But I expect higher than what we saw in the 2017 and 2019 local elections for sure.
Laura, we are almost out of time, and as always, it's a pleasure having you here. Next week, you and I are going to get together via the magic of Zoom, and I'm going to be in Arizona on the way back west, and I'll be joining you from a hotel room, and I'm looking forward to seeing you on Zoom from somewhere in Arizona next week.
Absolutely. Safe travels, Dennis.
Thank you, and thank you for listening, everybody. We are indeed out of time. You've been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be right back here via the magic of Zoom in this time slot next week with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. Between now and then, we hope you have a great week.